Hey there, and welcome to episode 241 of the weekly Google Cloud Platform podcast. As always, I'm Mark, and today we're here with Brian Dorsey. What's up, Brian?
Hello, hello. Welcome.
Always exciting to work with you. And of course, we have one heck of an episode scheduled. To get things started, Brian, can you tell us who's going to be joining us today?
Yeah, so we have a conversation with Sinanu and Elias about HPC, high performance computing, and doing it in the clouds.
Yeah, it's super interesting. And for our listeners who have stayed up to date, we had a cool conversation a little bit about this with NVIDIA. And I think that came up in our interview as well. It's such a cool idea, but I really liked the breakdown. Like, what is it? What are the actual pieces of it? What does it mean to be high performance computing or to do that kind of stuff? And then what are some cool examples? I really like this conversation.
So that is all there. And then right after that, we have a mini episode in the episode of Stack Chat from Home.
So it's not one, but two interviews. And with our Stack Chat at Home episode this time, we've got our friend Max Saltonstall talking to Eric Dull from Deloitte about cyber analytics and some of the cool stuff they built there. It's a pretty cool interview. I really liked some of the way that Eric talks about what the considerations that went into building a cyber analytics system are, and then how they built it using one of our favorite tools, BigQuery.
I have to admit, cyber analytics sounds a little vague, so looking forward to getting at the meat of that.
Very cool. Well, why don't we go ahead and move into our cool things of the week?
So my pick for the week is BigQuery, BigQuery. In particular, in the notes, there's a really detailed blog post from Jenny Palomino about just a bunch of new stuff in BigQuery. More time unit partitioning options, access control lists, more information schema, more control over slots and jobs. And it's a whole bunch of details. If you're already using BigQuery, you're probably going to be excited about that. But I also wanted to mention it just as an excuse to talk about BigQuery again, because I think BigQuery is one of those things where if you didn't know it existed, you would probably never go looking for it. My shorthand is I think about it as like an inverted database. Like in databases, you're always trying to stay on the indexes and avoid table scans. And BigQuery is all about table scans, all it does. And it spreads them out across thousands of machines so you can do queries you just wouldn't expect otherwise. So if you're using BigQuery, check out that blog post. If you're not, there's a new series that's kind of trying to talk about BigQuery from the beginning, explain all the way through. And there's a link to that kind of navigation post in the show notes as well.
Yeah, it's super cool. And we've done some videos on BigQuery as well, in BigQuery Spotlight, with our friends Alicia and Nick. So we'll make sure to put those links in the description. But it's like you said, BigQuery, like once you start using it, holy butts, it is so cool. And just to think about kind of the all the different things you can do there, but you just can't kind of get your head around it until you actually try it.
So, you know, you see demos of people doing a regular expression on every row in tens of millions long data sets, or doing these kind of like needle in the haystack kind of queries where you're like, okay, give me these seven rows in all of our web logs that have this, you know, request ID in them, you know, things like that.
And it takes like 30 seconds. Absolutely love BigQuery. And also, you know what? If you haven't gotten a chance to try it out for yourself, I'm sure some of these resources will definitely link to different ways to do it. But you could always just go to Quick Labs. You know, I've done a couple of BigQuery things on there, so I don't remember the titles of any. But there's got to be a lot of options there to just play around with it.
A bunch of interactive stuff there. And the other fun thing to do is kind of regularly ingested public data sets. So things like the Wikipedia logs and a bunch of weather data and taxi information, a whole bunch of stuff that I'm not even keeping up on. But there's, you know, a bunch of these data sets about the world that you can just kind of go poke at.
Yeah, it's just so awesome. So, I mean, for people who are interested, don't let anything stop you. Try it out. And like you said, those public data sets are pretty cool too. Well, I wanted to make a call out for my cool thing of the week. And, you know, just looking at the Google Cloud Platform YouTube channel, which is obviously something that myself and my team put a lot of content out there. And there's just so much cool content. I wanted to give a special call out to this one about serverless. You know, I was thinking of you, Brian, in our conversations. And one of your favorite things is like, where do I run my compute stuff? It's a very popular topic. You know, obviously it constantly changes and there's no right answer, right? And so the same question comes down to like, okay, fine, I want to try something serverless. What do I use? Functions, App Engine, Cloud Run? And so, you know, our friends Grant and Martin took this on and had a cool, very, you know, like detailed conversation about what these look like, you know, actually deploy some code to them and then kind of the considerations. So super cool. So check out this episode. It gives you a pretty quick breakdown and it's a lot of fun.
And my favorite, the answer that I think is staying true is it depends.
It always depends. It's the most annoying answer to get to.
Yeah.
Do I want A or B? And you're like, well, it depends. Here's a 35-page thesis on, and it's just like, yeah, I get it. But at the same time, like, there's a good reason you might choose A over B, or you might choose cloud run over functions or compute, or like all these different things do have trade-offs.
Good to see that laid out, and especially with code, so you can get a feel, because they feel really different to use, as well as, you know, kind of having overlapping but different technical constraints. So
yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, with all that out of the way, why don't we go ahead and jump into our conversation with Sananu and Elias? Sananu and Elias, thank you so much for joining us. To get things kicked off, can you tell us a little bit more about yourselves?
I'm Sananu Ago. I lead product marketing for Google Cloud, so I'm high performance computing solution. Been in this role for close to 2 years now.
Thank you for having us. My name is Elias Katsardis. I'm the HPC solution lead based out of London, but you know, with a global remit. And I'm also responsible to make sure that our customers have the perfect ecosystem. And basically, Google Cloud is their number one choice.
Awesome. Okay, so the topic here is HPC, like high performance computing. And my background in cloud is, you know, with the VMs and such. And it seems like, I mean, doesn't everybody want high-performing computers? So what is HPC specifically?
High-performance computing as a solution or as a practice is where we actually aggregate a lot of computing power to solve problems which are either too large for standard computers or will take too long. So if you think about it, it's more of the power and being able to have a lot more resources than you would ordinarily need. Previously, high-performance computing was restricted to large research centers, either in government or academia. And for large organizations that could actually afford it for their research and development work and to speed product innovation. The fixed nature of these resources, research had to be modified frequently to suit the existing system, or employees or those using the high-performance computing resources, mainly researchers and engineers, had to wait for long periods to either get their research through because the machines were overused, or even sometimes for the institutions that held them, their resources sometimes ended up being underutilized, which isn't really great. So where the cloud comes in is it makes HPC actually more flexible by offering resources that are elastic. Essentially, you can scale up and down as and when you need resources. And that is a great value proposition cloud gives HPC.
Right. So it's more than just like having a virtual machine with a bunch of resources about it. We're talking about taking a whole bunch of virtual machines, essentially, and tying them all together to solve real big problems, right? Because I have this image in my head from probably the 70s or the 80s where you have those server rooms just wall to wall computers. And that was, you know, obviously the compute power has changed a lot in the past 40 years, but that is now possible, you know, because you don't have to worry about the servers. You just get the power. So what are some good examples of things that actually take use of that?
So manufacturing is a big use case for high-performance computing. If you think of aircraft manufacturing or vehicle or even road bike, there's a lot of aerodynamics involved. So using high-performance computing to do the simulation or even the designing process, it's one big use case for high-performance computing. For vehicle manufacturing, for example, if you think about the cost involved in actually building the vehicle and actually testing it for safety features, a lot of these could be simulated in real time and using high-performance computing. Another big use case for it is in healthcare, especially life sciences, where high-performance computing is used to sequence genomes to find either the cures for diseases or just to prevent diseases altogether. So we've seen a lot of high-performance computing being used to solve medical problems these days. And interestingly, high-performance computing is also used a lot in animation. Most likely, your last animation you watched had some high-performance computing involved to render the output of the movie. So that is another big industry. And of course, there's also financial services, which uses a lot of computers for risk analysis. And a lot of these solutions or these problems have to be solved in real time. So financial services is also a big, big user of high-performance computing. Yeah, so those are some of them. I'm not limited, but those are some of the big enterprise use cases for high-performance computing.
So basically everything, right? But really, it's more focused on things that need a lot of power. And, you know, we had a cool chat with NVIDIA a couple of episodes back about what they were doing with their new A100s and what was available there. But we also, of course, had one of our friends, Emma, who was on the podcast probably, I think, last year. Yeah, because it was in the spring of 2019 when Emma broke the world record for the most number of digits of pi calculated. And she did that by basically taking Google Cloud's, you know, high performance computing offerings and kind of just letting them crunch numbers for a very, very long time.
Okay, so it's used everywhere. What does the technology actually look like? This is a tech podcast. Like, what software are people using? How does it go together? Like, what does the architecture look like? That sort of thing.
And actually, you might want to go a little bit on past, for example, to figure that out. You know, HPC is a very unique community, you know, apart from very smart people, which are dedicated to solving some of the world's greatest problems, as Sinan stated, right? So originally, they started from having very bespoke solutions in the early days, right? Like their own CPUs, their own hardware, everything was custom made. However, that right now, you know, is moving more and more towards to a more generic infrastructure that basically allows them to utilize economies of scale. For example, you know, their CPUs now, the building block is apart from many standardized compute resources, right? They don't make their own stuff anymore. They don't make hardware in terms of motherboards, etc. So they're basically trying to take advantage of the latest developments in the software area and then trying to utilize those to bring the generally available hardware closer to their needs, right? So something like a tailoring out of that hardware, right? In terms of programming languages, you will see that it's not a common basically to have a Fortran code that is having a little bit of C, C++ in there, and then another module that is using Python altogether, and all of them will coexist in the same site basically, right? In terms of what they're using now, cloud, so that is a little bit the software. And then you have to think about, okay, but what are the building blocks in terms of hardware that are putting all of those together, right? And this is where the idea of basically splitting your infrastructure into compute, network, and storage, which so many people are familiar with, right? That is also the same thing in high-performance computing. Of course, in HPC, the element there is that they care a lot more about the performance of those units, right? And that is the majority of their specialization as well. You have compute, which in Google Cloud, you know, it can take the shape of a memory optimized machine. For example, we have the M2 in Google Cloud, where basically it's based on Cascade Lake. You can have more than 400 vCPUs and believe it or not, 12 terabytes of RAM. And then you can actually go on something more compute optimized, like the C2 infrastructure we have. Those are fixed sizes, basically 4, 8, 16, 13, 60 vCPUs with 8 gigabytes per core ratio and the whopping 3.8 all-core turbo clock speed. That is based on Cascade Lake as well. And especially for this machine, we have actually done some studies and we have found out that you can actually expect a 40% performance benefit versus the previous generation, the N1. And not only that, but you also have something like around 1% runtime variability, which is really, really low. And it's what makes these machines stand out, specifically due to all of the innovations we and Intel jointly have done, like, you know, exposing a proper Vnuma architecture or enabling C-states and various things like that, right? Then, of course, you have the thing where I believe that Google is actually the biggest innovator in the cloud space, which is the customizable machines. So in that, we have the N1. Now we also have the N2 and N2D, which are based on Intel and AMD chips alike, which basically take this older idea of like, you know, you have your algorithm, but then you bought a bunch of machines. So now you have to squeeze the algorithm to actually fit the machines. That kicks the idea on its head. And basically now, here's your algorithm. You create it as it's best, and then you fix the machine to match that algorithm, right? And it's basically that where you can actually select as many vCPUs you think you need or you actually need, right? And then the RAM that goes along with it. And then you make sure that you are using exactly what you need. You're not paying for more than what you need. And, you know, a prime example of this use case is a memory-bound algorithm, right? So if your application is more than 8%, for example, let's say memory-bound, right? And you can achieve that by using 20 vCPUs. Going to 40, it will double up the resources in terms of vCPUs. It will nearly almost scale the cost of the solution, but all your performance is not going to improve that much because 8% was memory. So you didn't add more memory, for example, right? So that's what really sets us apart. Of course, we don't have only CPUs, right? You mentioned it earlier as well. We have recently announced the A2 VMs, which, you know, believe it or not, they are apart up to 16 A100 GPUs. right? And they can offer up to a 20 times improvement versus the previous architecture, the V100. It is mind-blowing, actually. And then we do have preemptible machines, where those can be up to 80% cheaper than a normal VM. And basically, they are used capacity. You know, we have to make sure that we have enough capacity for Black Friday, Cyber Monday, but then what happens in Lazy Tuesday, for example, right? So somebody can actually use these machines and take advantage of them. So of course, the only consideration you have is that if somebody is willing to pay full price on them, then, you know, it's not your preemptible anymore. It's somebody else's on-demand node, for example, right?
Okay, awesome. So it seems like the theme there is flexibility and getting the raw compute you need in exactly the shape you need when you need it. Okay. But compute alone doesn't get jobs done. Like, you need to store state somewhere. So what are the high-performance options as far as storage goes?
Yeah, absolutely. Not just doesn't get the job done, but even if it does, you will know because you didn't save the output, right? So it really means that, you know, you have to pay attention to that element as well. And it's something that, you know, you can see storage at a completely different lens on cloud, and especially in Google Cloud, because suddenly you don't have these blocks of disks that you put somewhere and that's your storage, right? So in Google Cloud, you can actually take anything from in-memory database storage systems to block storage to object storage, and you can actually use exactly as much as you need for each particular application. So everything can be quite uniquely matched to the best technology idea there, right? We have Google Cloud Storage, which is our exabyte scale object storage. And, you know, you pretty much, it scales automatically. You don't have to worry about it. You just use it as you want, right? And then we have our persistent disks, which is the, basically the backbone of our high-performance replicated block storage. It's encrypted both on transit and at rest, and it's basically your default option, right? Then, of course, we have local storage for the workloads that are a little bit more performance sensitive. We give you the option to have an NVMe attached there for scratch and basically fast access. And those are actually physically attached to the node via a PCI interface, right? Then we move on to a little bit more managed solution as well, like File Store, which is highly available and durable POSIX compliant shared storage across tens of thousands of nodes that you have. And then we also partner with many people like NetApp, DDN, Intel Deos to actually have bespoke applications and solutions in Google Cloud.
So basically, we have kind of a best-in-class version of all the different kinds of storage options.
I think you can say that, yes.
The last thing you mentioned was kind of networking and infrastructure.
Correct. It kind of goes with a job that you actually need to scale out, as we mentioned, right? So one node is never enough in high-performance computing. You usually need that node heavily interconnected with other nodes so they can jointly solve a much, much bigger problem that, as Sinanu said, it wouldn't have been possible by just one node, right? So in Google in general, we are very familiar with that idea, basically because of our data centers and, you know, we have laid hundreds of thousands of miles of fiber optic cables across the world, right? I think it's estimated a few years ago that 40% of world internet traffic goes actually through a Google data center or our network. But for HPC is specifically important, the VM-to-VM latency and network bandwidth, right? So for that, we have 32 Gbps now. It used to be 16 Gbps last year. We have doubled that. And for our GPU instances, we actually have 100 Gbps, which, you know, is basically much needed since the GPUs are so much more denser computing units, right? So they need to basically munch a lot more data. And then for our compute-optimized VMs, we actually have what we call compact placement policy, which is basically allowing us to take up to 22 compute nodes and put them in the same physical rack, let's say. It's our logical unit. And then that significantly reduces VM-to-VM latency. If you pair that solution along with our newly published MPI cookbook, you could expect lower than 8 microsecond latency ping-pong VM-to-VM, which is quite surprising for a lot of people to be achieved over Ethernet, for example, right? And then we are also working with vendors in the space, like Intel, for example, which we have a great cooperation. And recently, we have released basically the newer version of Intel MPI, and that offers up to 21% faster all-read use and, you know, MPI collectives between those two versions, right? So it's quite important to actually facilitate the whole ecosystem and not be alone in this.
So, I mean, that's obviously a great deep dive on the technology side of things. But I think largely, like you said, it's compute, it's storage and networking. The networking is fast, which is great because that's a good thing, right? I think everyone can agree. And then we've got the compute and storage, which have a lot of flexibility. And even the networking has some flexibility. I really like that. I never heard of the compact placement policy because that's really, really cool. Because I mean, some of these workloads are going to be so intense that they really, really need to be so close to each other. And that in cloud, typically, you don't get to think about that. So I love to hear about that. But a couple of times we talked about GPUs. So I'm interested to hear, I mean, obviously we're talking about HPC, right? So what role do GPUs play in this whole thing?
Ever since their conception, their HPC is trying to take advantage of GPUs as much as with any kind of new technology, really, right? These guys are trying to get the best out of anything that is available, right? I think they have done a really good job on the GPU front, and the different companies that manufacture them and the ISVs have really supported that ecosystem quite good as well. In its inception, you can think of the GPU as being a little bit more a specialized piece of hardware that offers you higher flops per device, right? But also there is a higher price to pay as well, right? So high compute power and increased cost make it a little bit imperative to keep the utilization as high as possible. And if your workloads speed up significantly, this is a much bigger challenge, right? You know, you run your workloads so much faster, it's done. How do you keep that device working on something without just repeating the same run, right? And that is actually what we have seen that makes cloud a fantastic solution for this kind of scenario, right? Because you can just use it for as long as you need, and then it's done. It's not your problem. You don't care about it. You stop using it. Your solution is done. Comes next day or next problem.
So it's basically just another piece of the puzzle that you can use. And I think the real key here is just all of that flexibility, right? Being able to run a batch job that you run once a night or even once a month, right? You can spin up these resources, use them, and then shut them down, and you can burst huge amounts of computing power in a short period of time.
Or as you know, you will see some of our customers doing, really spin up even hundreds of thousands of these compute units, for example, to finish something really, really fast and then done. They don't need to care about it for the next year, right? You see this in prototypes, in research, especially now with COVID, right? Where you have that instant demand for extra compute capacity, extra resources where, you know, you really need to use anything that is available for you for getting through the research.
This is a great segue into, like, what are people actually doing with this? Like, can you give us some concrete, specific examples?
Yeah, Brian. I will take Google Cloud's customer, Schrödinger, as an example. So Schrödinger is a customer that specializes in accelerating drug discovery with this advanced computational platform. So the platform essentially reduces the time and expense of getting a new therapeutic candidate through the discovery phase. And during COVID, Schrödinger has partnered with other health and life sciences companies to actually figure out a solution or a drug therapy for COVID faster. So, but if you think about a drug discovery process, it tends to run in bursts, and teams often need huge amounts of computing power for just a few days each month. So rather than build more capacity to address the current challenges, what Schrödinger has done is migrate their computational platform to Google Cloud. And the result is they have a lot more computational power now than ever before. And you can think of thousands of GPUs and hundreds of thousands of CPUs, which is essentially enabling and expediting the drug discovery work they're doing in partnership with other life sciences companies. So the end result is most likely they're going to find an effective small molecule drug therapy for COVID-19 faster than they could have if they were doing it purely on-premise. So that is one great example of how cloud is helping to drive and solve HPC problems much faster than ever before. Another good example, especially as we think of cores, is Clemson University. So a team at Clemson University showed how HPC can help plan evacuation routes during disasters by processing large amounts of traffic data efficiently and actually on demand. And if you think of many of the things that have happened this year, essentially stationary cameras are already in place along most highways, and they send updated information to data centers. But it's a lot of information. If you think of the number of cars and like different weather scenarios going on a particular day, it actually requires a lot of high capacity computing resources to actually process this data. And that is what the Clemson team did. In doing so, they set a record for the scale of a computation on a single problem in a public cloud by using 2.1 million cores. Like, dude, that's a lot of computers that would ordinarily not have been available on-premise. And back to many of the points we discussed earlier, the team at Clemson effectively learned that using a cloud-based solution with Google Cloud, they could actually launch and shut down required computational resources in just a few hours, and that it could efficiently process this data at a lower cost than many on-premise HPC systems could be. And if you think of a larger scale, the problem they're solving in terms of real-time evacuation management, this is an absolute great use case of how cloud and its ability to scale up and then out and very quickly helps to solve like real-life problems.
Yeah, and I think that's really the biggest importance is like, we probably have more data than ever. I feel comfortable saying that. And next year, we're going to have even more data than that, which is kind of how data works. But with all of this data, there are so many things that can be done. But the real like need there is like, okay, we've got people, we've got ideas. Now we just need to figure out how to actually crunch those numbers. So obviously for our listeners, you know, hopefully you have some great ideas about how HPC can actually help you unlock these things. And you've got the new bar now. So it's 2.1 million cores. So if you want to beat that, that's the number to beat, which I imagine is not a cheap number to beat, but definitely a lot of cores. I mean, just right. But, you know, we've talked about all the different flexible pieces, right? How does someone actually say, okay, I've got this idea. I want to get started with it. What does that look like on Google?
By the way, Mark, just bidding it doesn't count. You have to actually have a genuine use case that really makes it worthwhile, right? Because as you can see in Google Cloud, it's so easy to grab resources and actually run something that this is not you solving the problem. The problem you have to solve basically is make something good out of it, right? Because you can keep matrix multiplying, for example, these nodes. That doesn't count, right? Just want to make sure we're clear.
Fair enough. So there goes my plan to spin up 2.2 million cores just to do some math homework. Yeah, it doesn't quite count, I guess.
Yeah, especially if you think that you can spin it up for a minute or two, so it wouldn't cost you that much either, right? So that's not the way that you will get the record, no.
Okay, so if that's not the way to do it, how do teams get started here?
That's a great question, actually, because the zero amount of compute resources calls out for a really good way to control all of those and make sure that they are actually doing something, right? And not just hanging around, idling. So the solution really starts from on-prem, where all these guys, they couldn't actually, you know, use cloud and have that part of the problem taken care of, right? So that's where the idea comes, that you have basically a controller node or a few controller nodes in high availability, right? And then you have your login nodes, where it's basically the nodes that the users will interact, access, you know, maybe SSH or, you know, through a VDI interface. That's the nodes that they will work with. And then they will submit the workloads for the compute resources, where then an automated system is going to take care of that, you know, quality of services, everything, prioritize it, make sure that, you know, it corresponds to the business needs as well. And then run the workload on the compute node. And there can be like 10 work nodes, there can be 100 compute nodes, for example. It depends on what kind of variables that you will set out for the problem. And of course, those are basically being created from the Lego blocks that we discussed earlier, which is compute, network, and storage, right? And all of those in cloud, that's where the unique differentiator comes. Every job used to be basically different, but all of those other components used to be the same. So if you just wanted to submit a very different job, you would only have to basically use less cores, for example, or less nodes in this case, right? Actually, in Google Cloud, you can submit a different job that is using a different node, a different core, a different vendor, different storage. Everything can be finely tuned and optimized for your specific workload at that given second.
Wow. Okay. That sounds awesome. And then earlier you mentioned like MPI. So presumably there's like connections between various libraries that are commonly used in the HPC space.
You know, it's one of these cases that the message parsing interface is still as good as it was or even better. So you do have other basically use cases that might be more embarrassingly parallel, let's say, they're a lot less loose coupled, you would say, right? So you just submit a job, you can say like you take 10 work units, you take the other 10, and you can go on for 1,000 nodes and all of them that will match the data, do compute, and then give you back their portion of the result. When it comes to actually solving a bigger problem that all of those nodes have to actually cooperate, MPI is still, I would say, the golden standard of what people are using. That doesn't mean that there are not other options out there, but MPI is the most frequent one that we find.
And I think that's actually a really important point you just made too, because it's easy to think that you can just throw a bunch of resources at a problem and that'll make it faster. But it really has to be a task that can be made parallel, because otherwise you could throw 2.1 million cores at it and it's not going to solve it any faster unless you can actually split up the work that needs to be done, right?
Absolutely. And in some cases, you know, what you will do on the next step is heavily dependent on the previous number that you have. So, for example, this is a good case where you can think about the weather forecasting, right? You take the whole globe, you will split it down into hexagons or whatever your dimensions and, you know, scaling you want it to be. But if you're really doing a worldwide weather forecasting, for example, if you just compute the weather in Paris, right, in that border, you will have to do the Halo exchange to basically pass that information that you just computed. So the node that is responsible for the computing of the weather in London actually knows how the weather is on the boundary conditions, for example, right? And of course, you know, if we just did one node for London and one node for Paris, you know, it might be easier a little bit on London because, you know, chances are it's raining, but the results might not be accurate for Paris in that case. So you need a lot more.
Awesome. That makes it really concrete and easy to think about. This has been a great conversation. Is there anything we missed or that you'd like to mention for people to take a look at as we wrap up?
I'll just say we have a lot of information on our HPC website. This is cloud.google.com/HPC. We have some more case studies there. We have blogs. We have documentations and solutions for you to get started. We actually published a recent best practices on how to tune your Google Cloud resources for optimal MPI performance. So that is one thing that could be very interesting. And of course, we have Supercomputing, which is a big HPC conference coming up in mid-November. So Google Cloud will be there. We'll be having a very booth. So look out for us there and we'll have some exciting announcements as well. So
I love just saying exciting announcements because like you never know what that's going to be.
Right.
We'll make sure to put some links in the show notes.
And of course, there are many things that we cannot say in the public forum. So I think that they are interesting things that we can share with you. Please reach out under NDA. We will be more than happy to mention those.
Ooh,
that's the secret sauce right there. It's spicy.
Intriguing. Okay. So with that, thank you both very much for all the time. It's been super interesting. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, always good talking to you, Brian. Yeah, and thanks, Mark.
Thank you very much, guys, for having us.
So once again, thank you so much to Sananu and Elias for coming in. I learned so much about high-performance computing, and I feel like you could tell exactly how much of a novice I was beforehand because I literally had typed in high-powered computing.
I know.
It just didn't come to me that quick. It still works, right?
It's the same three letters.
And I'm sure all of that high-performance computing does draw a lot of power. So I feel validated by being technically right.
Technically correct is the best kind of correct.
As we know. All right. Well, I also want to make sure that we jump into our second conversation. So why don't we turn it over to Max?
Welcome to Stack Chat at Home. My name is Max Saltonstall, and I'm here with Eric Dull, a cyber analytics and AI lead at Deloitte. Thanks for joining me, Eric.
Thanks, Max.
So you have made a lot of really interesting data-driven models to understand cybersecurity, risks, threats. What makes this hard when you integrate with machine learning and AI?
The only problem is it's a really complex space. You can't write an equation because there are too many interdependent behaviors happening at the same time. And so we then want to apply machine learning, which traditionally you start with a big pile of examples of things that you want to teach the computer to do. And then you put it in your favorite algorithm.
Perceptron all the way.
And then you end up with this beautiful model. And the model gives you an answer and you just let it run and you catch the bad guys and all of those good things. Well, it's not that simple because labeled training data that is applicable to practical cybersecurity problems tends to be really, really rare.
And then so just the things you're trying to detect are rare too. It's not like tree or cat. Exactly. 99.9% normal stuff. And then that 0.1 or 0.01% is some wacky new thing. And it's maybe something that you've never even seen before.
Correct. And so this is actually where we start our successful applications of practical machine learning. And then we started what we call the unsupervised machine learning space, which is a fancy way of saying, choose a couple of those dimensions of complexity. You start with an expression of that feature space. You generally are able to do that in SQL or in Looker, and you put it in front of a human being analyst, and they start to get excited.
Cool. And now you're pulling data from a lot of different places as well. So can you talk to me a little bit about the inputs into this whole automated analytics system?
Yep. And data is the lifeblood. We operate on two fundamental types of data. We have client-sourced data, which tends to come from high-performance network sensors or the client's servers or other sources that give us really good visibility of what's happening inside their network. And then we have Deloitte commercial and proprietary data sources that come from outside of the network. These include commercial relationships we have that can help us with DNS data, IP registrations, as well as threat intelligence, things like that. We're looking at billions of events a day coming off of the high-speed network sensors in our client's network. And then that scales as you have more clients. And so you get this really big streaming ingestion laydown problem, which is a computationally interesting problem, right? And so there's a little bit of a data engineering exercise to do there to get them in the same namespace. But at the end of the day, or at the end of every 5 minutes, we ingest them into BigQuery and then run our standing analytics on them.
Yeah. And then just taking me through the life of like one of those, you know, bits of data, what happens next to get to eventually some analyst says, hey, I've got a problem.
Yep. We then merge and evaluate those outputs using another set of analytic workflows. And then we present those curated results in Looker or in Data Studio and email the analysts and say, hey, your stuff's ready. That tends to run early in the morning. We've got a geographically distributed team here in the US, coast to coast. And then they come in, they get their cup of coffee, and they've already worked out who's triaging what. And then they get on a chat channel and start turning those dashboards into events that they either call the client's incident response teams about, or we insert trouble tickets directly into the ticketing system on the client side for follow-up and remediation.
So you had a lot of different possible ways to build this whole system. You could have built it on-prem. You could have built it on your client's existing infrastructure. You could have built it on any number of public clouds. What motivated choosing Google Cloud to run this infrastructure?
I'm heavily motivated right now to do something that's maximally efficient. Deloitte builds and maintains analytic systems for our clients and ourselves. And we want a system that's stable, high-performant, and highly efficient. And we've found that Google's platform as a service approach gives us a number of wins here. Technically, we're seeing incredible scale out of the platforms as a service. We pushed the network sensor data in one of our BigQuery instances to 600 billion records. We saw no scaling impact of that, other than the query took a little longer because we didn't put lots of threads against it, right? And that is, as a technical leader, that's my first consideration. The second consideration I then have is, can I keep that data secure? Mm-hmm. And Google has 17 platforms as a service, including BigQuery and Looker, that have FedRAMP high inheritable controls, the highest cloud security standard the government has right now. But the most exciting thing to me is that we were able to stand up BigQuery and scale it to that 600 billion and test it in under 2 weeks with two people. And that's really fast.
So Eric, I want to give you a time traveling email so you can send yourself a message that you'll get 2 years ago and you can give yourself some advice. What do you wish you knew before you had taken this journey? It's got to be work related.
You need technology or the stuff, you need the people or the who, and then you need the practice or the how. And when I look at some cyber organizations or some analytic organizations, you tend to start by saying, well, we're going to get some tech and we're going to go do some stuff and then we'll figure out what we're doing in the middle. And that can work, but again, it's hard to keep the institutional momentum. I think that the most important thing is the practice of doing it. the technology, we can make any of it work, right? And the people are the foundation. And then what you have that team doing makes them a team and grows their skills and grows your ability to do analytics and data science over and over again. And so I would have reminded myself 2 years ago that whatever practice I was doing, those are the investments you're making for right now. You know, we started on this cyber analytics journey as Deloitte 6.5 years ago. And we've done some amazing things and we've stubbed our toes and we've learned a lot and we've delivered a lot of very valuable information to our clients. But the thing I wish I would have told myself 2 years ago is focus at solving that core only one pipeline problem. What decisions do we need to make? What investments do we need to make in our people and how our people work and how our people do big data so that we're not changing paradigms or changing platforms more than we have to?
Thank you very much for this fantastic conversation. I really appreciate you sharing what you've got and joining me here today.
Thanks, Max. It's been a pleasure. And I really appreciate the opportunity to share this with you and all your listeners.
Yeah, thanks so much, Max and Eric. I always love hearing these stories because they cover these really cool use cases. And I really like to see how, you know, the Google Cloud partners actually implement some of them. So super cool to see. I love the kind of the breakdown of how do you go from, okay, here's all this data we have. How do we actually build something around it?
And I think that wraps up our episode today as well. So thank you all for listening. Stay safe out there, everyone, and take care.